Good evening. I suppose you got one of what I've got. It's been going around. Your program notes are more than adequate. So what am I going to say? Well, I'll talk about the first half, which has three relatively short pieces. The first movement of the Schumann piano concerto. Schumann's rather unusual. Fortunate that he had his wife, Clara, who kept, in these days we call it nagging him, do this, do that, don't do this, and why don't you start writing for orchestra? Or you're writing all these songs and it's short pieces for piano. And so he did. And along with that, in a mutually embracement, they manufactured 8 children. I don't know where the descendants of Schumann are, but he certainly gave it a chance. Composers usually have some instrument that they play. Quite often it's violin. Let me see, I should start with the conductors. Conductors usually don't come from nowhere. They come from playing an instrument, usually. Usually piano or violin, but not necessarily. I'm a pianist, but I also play trombone, but trombone isn't what got me on the podium. I wish I could say it was my wife, but it wasn't. Schumann. He died early, didn't make it to 50, and unfortunately, like some other artists, suffered mental problems and ended up in a mental institution. But his wife stayed alive, and it was the three of them, two of them plus Brahms, were fast friends. So the piece you're going to hear tonight, the first movement, initially was just a fantasy. He hadn't planned it when he wrote it to be other than that. And she finally kicked him and said, get the second and third movements going also. But we won't hear those tonight. We'll just hear the first movement. Sarasati, every generation seems to have a genius on some instrument. And with us now, it's Otto Perelman and others. But back in those days, Sarasati was the violinist in the world, starting at a very early age, promoted. You think he made a lot of money, but there were an awful lot of first performances that he did of his contemporaries, which is a significant thing. And what you're going to hear, of course, is probably the most well-known work, the Zigeunerweisen, the Gypsy Airs, and the fiddle player here tonight has it all down, all the tricks that you can think of and some that you probably can't. The Lehár work, Franz Lehár, was counseled by Dvořák. All right, you're playing fiddle, but you really ought to be a composer. And after Strauss, Leonid Strauss, Kim Lehár, late 19th, early 20th century. And so he became a light opera and operetta composer of some 30 operettas, which at the time were performed. The only one that we really know any more about is does it say? Yeah, The Merry Widow, right. But there are a couple other tunes that he wrote that came from other operettas that we know. One is Velia. Da di da 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 di da da da. These are all very singable. And right after Lehár came Sigmund Romberg. You know, so that's all in that same vein. Lehár was born in the northern part of Hungary, in what is now or then Austria-Hungary, the eldest son of a bandmaster. What do you think? A lot of band directors that didn't start out playing cornet. Sousa was a violinist. William Ravelli of Midwest fame at the University of Michigan band was a violinist. They were known as that, but that's how they got started. Everybody had to get started, and usually get started on an instrument. So his father was a bandmaster in an infantry regiment of the Austria-Hungarian Army. He grew up speaking only, obviously, Hungarian until about age 12. Later, he put a diacritical mark above the A in his name to indicate the long vowel that belongs in Hungarian phonology. While his younger brother, Anton, entered cadet school in Vienna to become a professional officer, Franz studied violin and composition at the Prague Conservatory, where his violin teacher was Antonin, which means little Anton, Benowitz, but was advised by Dvorak, focus on composing music. So after graduation in 1899, it was long after my mother was born, he joined his father's band in Vienna as assistant bandmaster. In 1902, he became conductor at the historic Vienna Theater an der Wien, where his first opera was performed in November of that year. He did compose a couple of operas, but most of his compositions were operettas. What's the difference? Operas, everything is sung. Operettas, the songs are sung, and the exchange in conversation back and forth between the soloist is spoken. He is most famous for his operettas, the most successful of which is The Merry Widow, but he also wrote sonatas and symphonic poems and marches and a number of waltzes, the most popular being the one you're going to hear tonight, the Gold and Silver Waltz, composed for Princess Pauline von Metternich's Gold and Silver Ball. Some of these were drawn from his famous operettas, but individual songs from some of the operettas have become standards, notably Velia from The Merry Widow and You Are My Heart's Delight. Dinest my dance's habits. Lehár was associated with the operatic tenor Richard Tauber, who sang in many of his operettas, beginning with Zigeunerliebe in 1920, in which Lehár once again found a suitable post-war style. He's doing his biggest works between the two wars. Between 1925 and 34, he wrote six operettas specifically for Tauber's voice. In 1935, he decided to form his own publishing company, Glockner Verlag, publishing house of the bells, to maximize his personal control over performance rights to his works. And I think the reason he did that is that he sold to another publisher before he formed his own company, the Gold and Silver Waltz, for 50 gulden. And it made a lot of money. Everybody loved this, but he didn't get it. So that's why he formed his own company. So that's exactly the same thing that Irving Berlin did. Lehár and the Third Reich. Lehár's relationship with the Nazi regime was an uneasy one. He had always used Jewish librettists for his operas and had been part of the cultural milieu in Vienna, which included a significant Jewish contingent. Further, although Lehár was a Roman Catholic, his wife had been Jewish before her conversion to Catholicism upon their marriage, and this was sufficient to generate hostility towards them personally, towards his work. Hitler enjoyed Lehár's music, and hostility diminished across Germany after Goebbels' intervention on Lehár's part. In 1938, Mrs. Lehár was given the status of honorary Aryan by marriage. Nonetheless, attempts were made at least once to have her deported. The Nazi regime was aware of the uses of Mayer's music for propaganda purposes. Concerts of his music were given in occupied Paris in 1941. Even so, Mayer's influence was limited. It is said that he tried personally to secure Hitler's guarantee of the safety of one of his librettists, but the librettist still ended up in Auschwitz. But you'll hear tonight this wonderful work, Light, sort of continuing the tradition of Strauss. One of the things that's rather humorous is that aside from the one, two, three, maybe four different waltzes that are all strung together, there is an introduction. And so forth. And then we stop and we listen to an ad-lib measure by the harp. We have a wonderful harpist tonight, Anna Lorenz. She has a wonderful instrument, and this gives you an unimpeded chance to hear what she decides to add to what was already in the music. That's lethal. Okay? All right, I'm going to turn the rest of the microphone. I'll turn the microphone over to the rest of the speakers. This guy.
Thank you, Maestro. So, Dmitri Shostakovich, 1906 to 1975, probably holds the record of the composer who suffered the most under a repressive regime. He didn't pay for it with his life, but he certainly paid for it with his art. And he literally composed a symphony, which we will play for you tonight, which came at the price of his life. He knew that he had to write this music to save his life. And we don't usually think of music as being something where lives hang in the balance, but this particular symphony definitely qualifies for that. So the story to all of this is that he enjoys a successful early career. He's a musical prodigy. He's able to learn pieces of music by ear and then repeat them back to his teachers, and they trick him by putting new music down. He plays the last piece that he played. And they say, Dmitri, that's very good. It's nice that you can memorize many things, but we actually need you to learn music. He eventually is commissioned to go to the Petrograd Institute, the academy, and he is quite successful there and starts his composition career actually in high school. And his graduation piece is his first symphony. And it's a huge success. Bruno Walter actually hears it and brings it to Berlin and gives it its German premiere. And same thing happens with Stokowski. He actually takes it to Philadelphia and gives it the first recording in 1927. So Shostakovich receives a lot of accolades for this. Everyone recognizes his talents. But a signal event comes in 1934 when he premieres his first opera, which is Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk District, Russian name. And it's a big success, everyone likes it. And Pravda, the main newspaper in Moscow, essentially the only game in town, calls it the result of the general success of socialist construction of the correct policy of the party. It's complete nonsense, and everybody knows it. By the way, does anybody here know what Pravda means in English? Truth. Yeah, the Russian for truth. And so most people ignore what Pravda has to say until things turn. And then what Pravda has to say becomes very important. And that happens in 1936. Shostakovich is warned by a friend of his that he had better get down to the Bolshoi Theater tonight, because there's a very important person who is going to be seeing this ballet, this opera of yours. And so he shows up, and there in the front row is Joseph Stalin and the entire Politburo. And Shostakovich looks over the audience, and he sees that Stalin is sitting in the front row, and he's absolutely furious, he's quaking, and he's just really mad. Every time the orchestra plays a loud note, he is shaking, and the entire party is not. And in fact, Stalin is so angered by what he hears that he leaves the theater at intermission. And Shostakovich is utterly frightened. He is terrified because this is 1936. This is the beginning of the Reign of Terror, and Shostakovich knows what's at stake. And eyewitnesses say that as he took his bows that night, he was literally white as a sheet, and he was shaking himself. The next day, the other foot drops, and this time Pravda, having already reviewed this opera, now actually has this to say. And what Pravda says, from the very first notes, the listener is shocked by a deliberate dissonance, a muddled succession of sounds. Snatches of melody struggle free and disappear in the noise. To follow this music is difficult, but to remember it is impossible. While critics support socialist realism, Shostakovich presents the coarsest side of nature. Direct quote. So he already knows that his life is about to change for the worst, and in fact it does. He is not exiled, but his commissions drop sharply. He loses 75% of his income. He actually made most of his money from writing film music and was very successful at that. But all the commissions dry up, and he basically goes into hiding because he knows that the midnight knock at the door is gonna come. And he's in the process of writing his fourth symphony when this happens. And so he realizes what's at stake, shelves the symphony, doesn't actually resurrect it until long after Stalin is dead. It wasn't premiered until 1961. And what he does instead is he starts work on the fifth, which is what we're playing tonight. And he's basically saying to himself, what can I write that will be acceptable? And of course the question is always, well, how do you write music for people who don't know anything about music? How do you write music for people who control everything? Do you write patriotic hymns and call that good symphonic music? Or do you simply write what you actually want to do and then just, you know, charge forward? Well, it's a mystery exactly as to what his feelings are. He doesn't say much, even in his memoirs, about what his intent is in this symphony. But you can tell that everything matters. And he spends some time on this symphony. It's finally premiered in 1937, and it's well received. People discover that it's a gorgeous piece of music, because it is, and I can tell you that my unbiased, passionate opinion about this work is that I absolutely love it, so does most of the orchestra. And it's a favorite in the canon of great works. So what happens is people hear the music and they are tremendously moved by it because of the things that Shostakovich is able to say with notes and with melody and with harmony. So with all of this as a background, let's actually take a look at the piece itself. There's a lot of longing in the piece. There's a lot of emotional content. In fact, the score in many places all throughout the work actually says, play expressively. All musicians are told to play emotionally. This music matters. And so the first movement starts off with this tremendous dissonance that is reminiscent of the opera that was, of course, condemned by Pravda. And the dissonance is da-da, da-da. Da-da, da-da. And it has the same kind of echo that both Beethoven and Brahms are doing before him. Starting off with these powerful two-note motives, an entire unison in the orchestra, and setting the theme with the dissonance, with the augmented fifth, the minor sixth, which basically sets the kind of longing or emotionally wrought tone of the piece. So this happens. There's a lot of other thematic material in the first, and there is also a motive which permeates the entire symphony, which is the fatalist theme of dun 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 dun, and he echoes that all throughout essentially all four movements. And of course, you hear this, and you hear it for what it is. It's a dirge. It is music for funerals. The second movement is a scherzo, and it's in triple time, but it's faster than a waltz, so you can't really dance to it. But the idea behind this is that Shostakovich is maybe doing a parody on the dance form. He's doing a parody on collective reform under the Soviet regime. You know, we're all dancing, but there's no joy to what we're doing. And at the end, the basses actually take the melody and they ponderously restate it. And the idea, according to several observers at the time, was that this was the peasant class, and they were dancing in the fields as they were laying down their hammers and their sickles. But you can't really hear what they're dancing to because their boots are so heavy. And so this is echoed in the music. We get to the third movement, and the third movement is the most austere part of this music. It is actually a requiem. It is music for a funeral. And what is happening behind this is that Shostakovich actually does something that Tchaikovsky before him did in the 1812 overture, which is to take thematic music from the Russian Orthodox liturgy and set that to an orchestral arrangement. And he actually divides the strings so that they will sound like a choir that sings in harmony. And so the requiem then is, of course, for all of those who have been killed in the Reign of Terror. Most people are aware that Joseph Stalin was a mass murderer in the extreme. Most people may not be aware that he actually killed more people than Adolf Hitler. And at the height of his purges, at least 10% of all Russians were interrogated, and most of them were either exiled or executed. And Shostakovich actually escaped that fate himself. He was called down for an interrogation, and he showed up, and it turned out that his interrogator had been arrested for, you know, all of the abuses against the regime. So there was no one to interrogate him, so he was able to go home. But you can imagine what this is all doing to, you know, his art and his composition and everything that he's stating in the Fifth Symphony. So, of course, if Shostakovich ended the symphony right after the third, right after the funeral, then he would know that he's done. He will not survive if that's where the music ends. Because you can't end a symphony on a downer note. You have to have a rousing, patriotic theme, and you have to bring things back. So, for the fourth movement, he raises the question of, well, how can you write happy music after we've just surveyed the battlefield? Right? After we've just looked over the cemetery, what can you respond with? And so what he does for the fourth then is he actually takes a series of themes with a steadily urgent rising acceleration, both in tempo and also in dynamics, and turns this into essentially a series of patriotic marches, but also each of these marches are tinged again with this minor sixth. So even though it sounds patriotic, there's this hint then of the deep sadness that is behind everything that he's doing. So he finally ends the entire symphony then with this recapitulation of the death march, the dun dun dun, and he repeats that in the finale, and then finally leaves the whole thing still hanging. He doesn't resolve this, but he leaves it as the unanswered question. This is my statement of the symphony, and I don't resolve it. And this is by design. So a lot of people have written, you know, buckets, oceans of ink over this particular symphony because they've been looking for the hidden message. You know, was Shostakovich trying to tell us about his torture? Well, yes, he was. Was Shostakovich trying to capitulate to the Communist Party or poke fun at it? Well, maybe both at the same time. Maybe he was trying to write music that would be acceptable but still subversive, still controversial. No one really knows. People have written all sorts of, you know, master's theses over this very issue for decades, and, you know, it's one of those things that you can never resolve. The best quote really comes from Shostakovich himself. And this is what he had to say about the fifth in his memoirs. He says, "I will never believe that a man who understood nothing could feel the Fifth Symphony. Of course they understood. They understood what was happening around them, and they understood what the fifth was about." So, as you listen to the piece tonight, pay attention to all these little bits and pieces, and put yourself in his position. Imagine that you yourself are writing music to save your life. Because that's literally what this symphony is all about. All right, so great piece of music. I can't speak enough about it. Enjoy the concert. And I will also ask you that if you have a cell phone at this time, please pull it out, throw it into the air. I will do my best to catch it. And let's see, Alan, there's one other thing that you... Oh, no, yes. There is also no photography, no digital cameras, no nothing. There is one authorized photographer here, and that is it. Okay? Thank you for coming. Enjoy the show.